You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast with your host, Tony Award winner, Ken Davenport.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, we have Jack Vertel, a theatrical jack of all trades, who's going to talk about what makes a great musical and why he almost swore off Broadway for good. But before we get to that, first of all, big thank you to all for all the notes and reviews we've gotten recently. It means a lot to me and all the guests who've given their time to be here. I want to give a shout out to Ken Offrecht, Greg J88, and Brittany Fan 12333 for your great reviews on iTunes. If you have a moment, give us a thumbs up or some stars on iTunes or whatever service you're listening to, and that'll help us keep getting great people like today's guests, like Jack Vertel and all the other ones we've had. Before we get there, today's podcast is brought to you by Copacabana Coffee. Get it? That's like Copacabana, but Copacabana Coffee. If you were at our conference and had coffee, you'll have noticed two things. One, we ran out fast. And two, it was good. And we ran out because it was so good. That was Copacabana Coffee. They are the premier mobile espresso and coffee catering service in the tri-state area, providing a full-service coffee catering solution for your next wedding, corporate event, trade show, or fundraiser. And their coffee tastes so good because of their proprietary blend of espresso beans from around the globe. They'll give you baristas and, of course, all the vanilla and syrupy good stuff you want. So give them a shout out. Give them a Google, Copacabana. And now on with the podcast.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Thank you all for listening. We have a literal jack of all theatrical trades on the podcast today. Please welcome to the podcast, Mr. Jack Vertel. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So if Jack sounds a little different, as we are recording this the day after the first snowstorm in New York City of the season, and as we all know, that can put a damper on things. So Jack is remotely calling into this podcast. So we thank him for that, for the little extra effort and showing up today. If you go to Jack's IBDB page, this is how it lists him. Producer, theater owner slash operator, conception, creative consultant, writer, and other, which means he's done even more on Broadway that other than all the other titles before it. That page goes on and on and on, by the way. The full bio is he's the senior VP of Jujamson Theater. He's been involved in dozens of productions presented by Jujamson since 1987, including Pulitzer Prize winners and Tony Award winners like City of Angels and Angels in America. All the Angels show, apparently. Also helped shepherd six of August Wilson's plays to Broadway. He's the artistic director of New York City Center's acclaimed Encore series, which is presenting a terrific chorus line right now. He conceived the long-running Smokey Joe's Cafe and the critically acclaimed After Midnight, and also this season's The Prom, which opened last night to great reviews as well. He's having quite a week. Been a creative consultant on many shows, including Hairspray, A Christmas Story, and Dear Evan Hansen. Was the Mark Taper Forum's dramaturge and the drama critic and arts editor for the LA Herald Examiner, and also a teacher at Tisch and the author of The Secret Life of the American Musical. I mean, Jack, you've done it all. Something tells me you like the theater.
Yes, well, that's an encyclopedic introduction, and I appreciate it, but I have to say it makes me blush. I do love the theater, and I think the only reason I've done so many things, so many different things, is that there was no one thing that I could become the king of, because I don't have that kind of talent. So I sort of went in any door that anybody would open when I knocked on it.
And where did you get infused with this love of theater? How did it start?
Well, it literally started with a bang all at once when I was almost 6 years old, and my parents and my grandmother took me to see Mary Martin and Peter Pan. But that really changed, or as I like to say, ruined my life. But it came out of the fact that my parents and my father's father, going back a couple of generations, were all theater people in one sense or another. So that the whole family grew up going to the theater, and as the baby in the family, my brother and sister were going all the time. My parents were going all the time. I feel like I was just went right from the cradle to the winter garden.
And what was the first gig you had?
The first gig I had?
Yeah, first job.
Well, it doesn't really qualify, but when I got married and moved to Los Angeles, I volunteered for the fledgling Los Angeles Shakespeare Festival, just because I didn't know who else to call, and I figured it was a free Shakespeare Festival and they must need somebody if they weren't charging any money for tickets, and I had some hours to give, so I guess that would technically qualify. But my first real gig was as a theater critic for a weekly newspaper out there called The Reader, which was sort of like the equivalent of the Village Voice. It was a paper that was given away in boxes on the street corners. And then I went from there to the Los Angeles Herald Examiner as a theater critic, and then suddenly realized in a blinding flash of, intuition that I was in the newspaper business and not in the theater business, which wasn't the point. So I hopped a freight over to the Mark Taper Forum and, got off the devil's side and onto the angel's side.
You're one of the few people, maybe the only, that was a theatrical critic turned producer and writer in the theater. What did you learn from as a critic that helped you do what you do today?
I think being a critic was hugely helpful because I had to go watch shows 3-4 nights a week and write about them the next day, and I had a couple of hours to file a review. And seeing so many stories told theatrically well and poorly, I think just after a while got under my skin and into my blood, so that I had some instinct about where stories go wrong and where what it takes to captivate an audience. I can't say I've ever come close to perfecting it, but there's no doubt that that experience of writing about literally hundreds of shows, was a big help in terms of my professional development.
What's the greatest lesson you learned from being a critic and seeing all those shows, especially the bad ones?
I don't know if there was a single lesson that I learned. I learned when I was getting bored and when I was getting annoyed. And I think those things came from different sources, sometimes bad performances, sometimes sloppy, excessive writing and self-indulgence. But it sort of put me on the lookout for all those things when I looked at projects as a producer later on. And also, on the positive side, I began to notice, certain things that would always engage my attention and other things that would never engage my attention. And I think, that it's helpful to know what those things are.
So as we talked about, and you've already mentioned, you do a lot of things. Some people, success-minded motivators, would say, you have to focus on one thing, and that's it. I have a hard time listening to those people myself. But you do a lot of things, and it's a very humble answer to say, well, anywhere that would let me do it, I'll do it. But you've done a lot, and you've done them all very successfully. What is your wisdom there? Like, how do you manage to pull that off?
It's funny. I don't think about it in those terms. I think I sort of think of each job, even if it's a different type of job from the last job, as a job. And the question is, how do you do this job well? What's required? What's really needed here to do a good job? And so, if you're working as a creative consultant, which I do now a lot on shows that are not, I'm not producing and not you know, just hired on as a hired hand, basically, to say, I think this might work better than that. I think one of the things I've learned over the years, and I certainly learned being a critic was helpful because it's the opposite of what I'm about to say, is you have to know that it's the artist's show and not your show. So when you want to be helpful, you have to be helpful. You can't say, if it were my show, I would do it this way. You have to say, it's your show. How can I help you achieve more of what you're trying to achieve? And that sometimes requires taking a step back in terms of your own impulses of what a show could be, but it also requires a lot of time and energy spent, well spent, earning the trust of the people you're working with, because there's no reason why any artist should listen to me about what's a good idea or a bad idea, how to make a show better or worse, unless they believe that I'm on their side and I sort of know what I'm talking about. And that takes time. I mean, artists are not actually trusting of people who walk in the room and start to give notes, and I don't blame them. So you have to really become part of the process in a positive way.
Since you were a critic before, how do you feel about them now when you're involved with a show like The Prom? Obviously, last night, you probably feel great about them because they gave you a lot of love.
Last night, they were all geniuses. most of them were, anyway. When I was a critic, I felt like I was telling people the truth about their show, and that was the only truth that there was about their show, and it was very arrogant. And I did not actually know how shows got put on at that point in my life. I was relatively young and sure of myself at a time when I shouldn't have been. And I've come over the years to think that, you know, critics do have their, I don't think I'd call them prejudices, but their preferences anyway, in terms of the kind of material that appeals to them, the kind of performances that appeal to them. And so they're really doing their job, and all we can do is do our job. And I think trying to second guess a critic is a terrible mistake. And the one thing I really push back against when people in our industry say it is, oh well, he hated that show last night, so he'll probably like this show today because he isn't going to want to write two pans in a row. I don't know any critic who ever thinks that way. They go into the theater hoping to have a good time, and they come out and say what they thought. And you know, I think we attribute a kind of, evil monster quality to them that just is simply made up in order to comfort ourselves.
Yeah, we've had we had Ben on this podcast. We had Charles on this podcast, Chris Jones. And the one thing I was reminded of in talking to all of them is that they love the theater. That's right. Why they do what they do.
That's why they do it. They want to go.
If they were in it for the money, just like all of us, we'd all be investment bankers or something. So.
Yeah.
What do you think? The most important job of a producer is, well, I'm not, this is a two-parter. When you started in the business, what was the most important job of a producer, and has that changed? And if so, what's the most important job today?
Well, I don't know that you can actually quantify something as the most important job. What's changed most in my lifetime is, I always think of producing as something that is split into two, not exactly separate, but almost separate, but equal parts. And one is having some creative vision around what you're trying to do, although it's the artists who have the real creative vision. But you're starting, particularly with musicals where there are multiple authors, you're starting with a leadership role in figuring out what you think a show should be, why you think a show is worth doing, how you think you can help the development of the show. And for a long time, that's the most important job. But once a show is up and running, there's a separate component, and that has gotten 100 times more complicated in the time that I've been here, which is how to run the show, how to manage the show, how to promote the show, how to sell the tickets, how to market the show. That was a fairly simple process in 1987. You know, you opened the box office, you took an ad in the New York Times, you had an ad agency, you had a press agent. You saw who showed up to buy a ticket. Now, with the advent of social media and all kinds of internet marketing and the many different ways that we sell tickets and different ticket sellers we deal with, that has become a hugely complicated job. It was always a time-consuming job, but it never had as many dimensions as it has now. I must say that for me, the creative part, the part before opening night and before you start spending enormous amounts of time sitting around with people trying to figure out marketing, that creative part has always been the more enjoyable part for me.
So you conceived Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Correct.
Which is one of the longest running reviews on Broadway, if not the, right?
It's the we've always said it's the longest running musical review on Broadway.
I love it.
And it may actually be the longest running review. I don't know, but it was a particular kind of review. And if you go all the way back through the history of Broadway, there were lots of reviews that had sketches that had even mild stories to them. So we never compared ourselves to those shows.
So let me ask you a business question first, because I remember working, I was at the Brett Adams agency as an assistant to Brett at the time. And I don't remember who was associated with the show, but we used to get royalty statements on it. And I remember Brett saying to me, like, this show, we didn't think it was going to last past 3, 4, or 5 months, and it's going and going and going, and ran a long time, obviously. What was the secret to you all stretching out that run like you did?
Well, initially, the show was very, you know, it was faltering. It didn't get great reviews, and it got some outwardly very, I mean, some, you know, really hostile reviews, and there was nothing in particular to sell about it. It didn't have a big star or a great, you know, it wasn't written by a famous playwright or anything like that. So we were just sort of, it was sort of a business in which we just kept plowing back any money that we got into the show. And then it really was turned into a hit by two things not entirely in our control. One was the appearance on the Tony Awards. And the other was the fact that the radio jock Don Imus was a huge fan of the show. And in those days, his show was a local New York show. It was not a national show. So he was free to talk about it as much as he wanted. And he talked about it endlessly and with huge amounts of enthusiasm. So the show became a hit. The show is not an expensive show to run. You know, it had a relatively small cast and a small band. And as it began to fade, after 3 or 4 years, we started to bring stars into it who were not Broadway stars. They were, you know, rock and roll stars in the oldies world, people like Benny King. And that kept the box office, you know, up above average for a long time. And it was the kind of thing that is now absolutely routine to do. If you look at a show like Waitress and how it's cast and recast and recast, you know, everybody does that now, but we were one of the early ones in that.
So that's my business question. Now I want to talk the creative part, because you did conceive it. What does that mean exactly? And how did it happen on Smokey Joe's? Tell us that story.
Well, I'll admit the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I wanted desperately to do a Lieber and Stoller show. Lieber and Stoller were heroes of mine when I was a little kid. I mean, Yakety Yak got me through summer camp. And I knew who they were, even at age 9 or 10. I mean, I didn't know who they were in any detail. I just knew that they were the writers of every record that I, well, not every record, but so many records that I loved. And I loved the comedy, you know, the sort of novelty quality of a lot of the records. And so I was just a Lieber and Stoller guy. And it occurred to me at some point, probably 2 or 3 years before the show saw any kind of light, that you could do a Lieber and Stoller review the same way that Richard Maltby had done Ain't Misbehavin', which was a Fats Waller review. And I've always considered Ain't Misbehavin' the most perfect example of that kind of musical review ever created. And I still think that, even as the conceiver of Smokey Joe, I think it. And so what I did was I literally did this. I put up a big bulletin board on my wall, and I took every song in Ain't Misbehavin' and I put it on a file card and who sings it. And I made a long column of Act One and then a second long column of Act Two. And then I took a bunch of blank file cards and put them next to the file cards from Ain't Misbehavin'. And I thought, I'm just going to steal Ain't Misbehavin' lock, stock, and barrel. And started asking myself, okay, so why does this person sing this song at this point? What's really going on here? And I realized that Ain't Misbehavin', the entire show is a trajectory towards Black and Blue. I mean, everything that happens in that show and every lyric that Richard rewrote, everything that he brought to the table in terms of the kinds of people he cast in it, was headed toward that moment of confronting what it meant to be Black in America. And I thought, okay, so you have to get you have to get to something like that. And little by little, I began to put together what seemed to me a trajectory about it started in a neighborhood, and then everybody grows up and they get older and they go out into the world and they get in trouble and they fall in love and they fall out of love. And eventually they're reunited after, you know, a series of particularly kind of, you know, traumatic torch songs. So it didn't have the social angle that Amos Behaven had. It wasn't about a social issue, but it was about, I thought, a human issue. And like Amos Behaven, audiences don't even know that that's happening when they're watching the show. And so that's, I guess, what I mean by conceiving the show.
Yeah, hold on. I think I have Richard Maltby on the other line right now saying, what the?
We've talked about it a million times.
But I love that. You know, it's genius, because so much of creating something new is looking at the structures, right, of the classics that have come before you. And that's what you did.
And the thing that I really had faith in, and I'm glad it turned out to be true because it might not have, was that because these songs were so different and written in a different era for a different audience, even if I stole the damn thing almost to a point where he could sue me, you'd never recognize it. It would be a new thing by the time you got finished with it. And it is a new thing. And you know, Richard and I have laughed about it.
So do you think, let's take a more traditional musical for a moment. So you sit down, you got a blank sheet of paper, you're going to write a brand new musical. We can use The Prom as an example, or we can use a fictional, whatever you'd like. Do you do something similar, or do you recommend other writers do something similar? Like, look at a classic and where are your highs and peaks and valleys, lows and highs, ballads and up-tempos?
Oh, yeah. I think I think one of the reasons that people complain all the time about the lack of, quote, original, unquote, musicals, meaning musicals not based on any underlying material. But the reason so many of the successful musicals are based on underlying material, I think, is that that material works. It has a structure. It has a story that is reliable. And it gives you a lot of hints about how to do what when in terms of both the book and the score. So you are always, I think, to some degree, retelling some kind of classic story in a musical. Not, and when I say always, I don't really mean always, but I mean most often. And I think you definitely sit down and you look at kind of identifying what the source material of your show might be, even if it officially has no source material. And then you start to think about, why does that story work and what makes it work and what happens at this point in the story that turns it in a different direction. And, you know, you can learn a lot from that without really slavishly imitating something.
Do you think any idea can become a musical, or there's some stories that are just best not told on the musical stage?
Well, I think there probably are, you know, a number of stories for various reasons that don't need to be musicals because music doesn't help them at all. But I will say that the one, and I raise this point in my book sort of emphatically, or maybe over emphatically, the one sort of rule that I live by is it's almost impossible to write a successful musical unless you have a protagonist who is active and wants to achieve something very specific and wants it desperately enough to fight for it virtually to the death, which is not true of movies and not true of novels, but it does seem to be true of musicals. You got to have somebody who gets out there and says, I'm going to be a producer, or I'm going to be something, you know, or else they tend to be very difficult to keep the audience's energy focused because the story isn't being driven hard enough.
You have any example from history of a musical that did not have that didn't make it?
Well, there are lots of musicals that didn't make it because of that, I'm sure. And I suppose I could think of one, but the one I like to point to because it's one of my favorite shows that has never really been, you know, a blockbuster in any form is Company. Company has a great I Want song, but it's the last song in the show. And until that point, that character is sort of adrift. And I think that the show, which I, as I say, I'm not totally in love with, it brought me back to Broadway after I swore off Broadway forever, for a brief period, has never found mass success, in part because it doesn't have a trajectory that just goes forward the way that, you know, West Side Story goes forward, or The Music Man goes forward, or Hairspray goes forward, or Hamilton.
I always say that Sondheim is probably the only author that can pull that off.
Yeah.
Like, no one else has that kind of genius to make a show that shouldn't work on a musical stage. You can make people like them. Yeah.
Yeah, and yet, when you look at something like Sweeney Todd, which has exactly the kind of character I'm talking about, it's been seen by many more people than Company. Because
right.
Yeah, that story is irresistible.
Right.
I mean, that guy has been wronged, and he's going to get his revenge, and now you're interested.
Yeah, there's no – it's no coincidence why that is his most, quote-unquote, popular.
Yeah.
So I laughed when you said it, but I'm not going to let you get away with saying it without digging into this a little more deeply. Why did you swear off Broadway for a while?
Well, I have to remember this was in 1968 that I swore off Broadway for a while. And, you know, we were knee-deep in the anti-war movement. And, you know, it just seemed like commercial claptrap to a 18, 19-year-old college boy who had – lived and died by it for many years, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to reform now. I'm not going to do this. And then Company was trying out in Boston, and I was in school in Boston, and I had loved. Funny thing happened on the way to the Forum when I was a kid, and I'm one of the few people who I wish I had saved the stub to prove it, who had actually seen Anyone Can Whistle, and I was just a big Sondheim fan, and I hadn't been heard from in a long time. So I went to the. Did it try out at the Colonial? I think it may have tried out at the Schubert. But in any case, it was in Boston. And I was just floored by it because it was actually about a serious subject and was unbelievably contemporary, and the music was really exciting. And I thought, well, to hell with swearing off Broadway. I'll get back into it as long as this guy's in it, I'm in it. But there were a lot of, you know, it was not those years, those 67, 68, 69, those were not great years for classic Broadway shows. I mean, it was just Sondheim sort of redefined that world at a time when it badly needed redefining.
Well, now look, I just walked to my office down a few streets which have Broadway theaters on it, and I saw Frozen, and I saw Harry Potter, and I saw a bunch of jukebox musicals. A bunch of people would argue we're a commercial claptrap now. What do you think about the battle between commerce and art right now?
I think it's a really fascinating time because, well, you know, I don't want to characterize any show as commercial claptrap anymore because, after all, I'm a Broadway producer. But what I find so fascinating is that people have grown to love musical theater in a different way. And so the result is that anything can be a musical. I mean, not everything is a good idea for a musical. But shows like Dear Evan Hansen and Fun Home that would positively have been straight plays in 1970 are now musicals because any subject is fair game. And that really was not true when I was growing up. I mean, there were the occasional big tragedies like West Side Story, but there were not a regular menu of shows, of musical shows on consequential and difficult subjects. It really was the era of the Tired Businessman musical for the most part. And now we can do anything we want as a musical, and it's a thrilling time. Simultaneously, of course, there's a big commercial entertainment business going on Broadway that includes Disney and, you know, other organizations that are sometimes producing shows that are, you know, done principally because they believe there will be a lot of ticket buyers who want to see them, as opposed to because of the subject matter or, you know, a political stance that they have or whatever. But it's so much more variegated a field than it used to be, which I find just thrilling.
Yeah, I agree with you. I actually think there's something for everyone right now, including the family audiences, et cetera, that Disney has helped, frankly, I think they've helped rebuild Broadway over the last 30 years.
No question about it.
And Harry Potter is a perfect example of a show that would seem commercial but is so artistically done. It's a great marriage of both worlds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and these shows do have commerciality built into them, whether, you know, shows like Harry Potter before you even know whether they're any good or not. But the ones that are good are good.
Yeah. So for someone who loves musical theater as much as you do, Encores must be like a giant sandbox for you. Just like, what a playground.
That is what it is. It is an amazing, amazing thing that's happened to me. I consider myself the luckiest person in the world when I walk through the stage door of City Center. You know, we've been able to do pretty much anything we want to do for the last however many years. The series is 26 this year, but, you know, it took a few years to get established. And the result is that we've discovered a number of really wonderful shows and semi-wonderful shows that have really wonderful elements in them. And we have a loyal audience. And so if we want to reconstruct, you know, Cole Porter's The New Yorkers, which I haven't seen in 80 years, we just did it. And God bless, you know, Ben Pradley for loving it. But it was, you know, that kind of, that's how, if you love musical theater the way I do, it's hard to picture anything that's more fun than that.
What's been your favorite production up there?
I don't think I have a favorite. There have been some awfully big highlights. I felt very lucky to be able to do Follies, which is my personal favorite musical. We did The Most Happy Fellow really well, I think. We did do The New Yorkers really well. That production of Brigadoon last year that Chris Wheeldon did for the City Center Gala was amazing. There's been a lot. And sometimes the things that don't present the most obvious profile have so much gold in them, even though they're not wholly successful shows as shows, like there's a Gershwin show called Pardon My English that I'm thinking of, that the opportunity to take this stuff out of the box and dust it off and look at it and figure out a way to make it entertaining for an audience today is just a blast. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun work.
What's a show in the musical theater canon that has yet to be revived that you would love to see on stage again, whether it would work or not?
Oh, there are many of many different types. I mean, going all the way back to Little Johnny Jones, which was in 1906, the George M. Cohan show, which did have a very brief, I believe, one performance revival in the 80s. But the original version of Little Johnny Jones, I just love to know what that show is. You know, there's a chunk of it in the Jimmy Cagney movie about Cohan, but I'd love to just know what that show is. And then more recent things, you know, we all have our guilty pleasures, shows that we saw when we were young that had a big impact on us that may not be perfect shows, but I'd sure like to see I can get it for you wholesale again, and, you know, I'm hoping I will at Encores soon. But, you know, there are a lot of shows like that. And then there are great shows where, I mean, if I could get in a time machine and go back and see what the original production of Showboat really looked like, it felt like, it sounded like, I'd be on the time machine.
You've worked on a whole bunch of shows, and obviously the odds are that more are going to be less successful than others, shall we say.
Yes.
How do you not swear off Broadway every time one of these shows doesn't work that you've invested so much in creatively, emotionally, financially? How do you pick yourself up and keep going?
I'll tell you, it literally comes down to one particular moment that I had after we had done a show that was a complete – that sort of went out on a limb for – this was back in the days when Rocco Landisman was running Jew Jamson. And it was a disaster. It closed in a week, basically. But the morning that we came in after the reviews, all of which were terrible, and this had been kind of a pet project of mine, Rocco said to me, "Well, you have to kill yourself." And what he meant was, you don't have to kill yourself. You know, you of course you feel like you have to kill yourself, but you don't actually have to kill yourself. This is part of the business. And I carry that with me all the time. Like, it's okay to wake up in the morning and say, I have to kill myself about a Broadway flop. But, you know, it's not my funeral. It's only a flop.
What was the show?
Oh, I don't think I want to mention the title. It could hurt some people's feelings.
Well, you'll tell me off the air, and then I will tweet it. No, I won't. I promise. So I want to, you talk about Rocco and I want to get a little bit into your role at Jew Jamson. The role of the theater owner, how has that changed over the last few decades?
Well, in our case, when I got to Jew Jamson in 1987, our mandate from Rocco, who had just been appointed president of the company, and Jim Binger, who owned the company at the time, was in order to fill our theaters, which were all empty, we're going to have to produce every single show that goes into our theaters, because there's no way to be it just a landlord anymore, because there is no Broadway to speak of. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine in today's landscape, but four of our five theaters were empty. I would guess 10 or 11 of the Schubert theaters were empty. I mean, there was nothing to put in these theaters except Cameron McIntosh, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Peter Schaffer, you know, all of whom were very, very close to the Schubert organization. So if we wanted to do a show, we'd have to produce it. And so we produced everything in those early years. We put enormous amounts of money into shows, starting with the original production of Into the Woods and Butterfly in the same season. And we worked hard creatively on all of those shows. And little by little, as the landscape transformed itself completely, the theater owner became less and less important as a producer, because we were able to book shows, which was much lower risk than producing them. And Jim Binger, who lived in Minneapolis and owned the company, said, "Stop using my money to produce these shows. We don't have to do it anymore." So we stopped, except for, I mean, I think Rocco said to him, "Okay, but I'm running your company and I'm going to produce shows that I love and want to produce. I'm not going to produce everything." And Jim said, "Okay, just don't lose any of my money." So, you know, that led to things like The Producers and, you know, some other Angels in America. But, you know, the theater owner simply isn't the driving creative force behind Broadway that he or she once was. Although I think in each case, you know, there are things that Jordan Roth, who now runs Drew Jampson, feels very strongly about artistically, and that will have an impact on what's in Drew Jampson theaters. And I think that's true of each of the theater owning chains. But they aren't in a position where they have to produce everything that goes into their theaters.
Okay, my last question, which is my genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you and wants to thank you for everything you've done for the theater by granting you one wish. So what's the one thing that really gets you upset these days about the state of Broadway that actually would make you want to swear it off right now that you'd ask this genie to wish away in an instant?
That's a hard question.
I'm going to make it harder. You can't say ticket prices.
No, you know, I actually think ticket prices are a very open question, because I think there are very expensive tickets and there are also very good discount tickets. So I have a, you know, I'm trying to have a very broad view of that. No, what I actually think it would be, and this will probably end up being saying this on the, you know, or to you in a place that's going to be broadcast, could be the end of my entire career. I wish that there were fewer producers of each show. I wish that the shows were not so expensive to produce that they didn't have to have 15 or 18 voices in the room and another 25 or 30 people who either think they should have a voice or resentful that they don't have a voice. You know, there was a time when producers were one or two people, partners, who would put on a show and it would be their vision that would control the show. And there are so many people to answer to today, many of whom aren't really experienced theater people, that I think does not help. And I would ask the genie to get us back to the point where we have very small and well-coordinated collaborating producing teams.
Yeah, producing by committee certainly never works. You still have to have one captain of the ship.
Correct.
Well, a very good answer, and I think your career's safe there, Jack. Well, something tells me you're going to be okay.
Okay, well, I appreciate your faith.
Thank you so much for being here. Everyone out there, go see The Prom. Just opened last night to great reviews, as of the date of this recording anyway. And go get his book. It's terrific. The Secret Life of the American Musical, available on Amazon. We will put a link in the blog post about this podcast. Thank you all of you for listening. We will see you next time. Hey, do you want to sponsor this podcast? Email chris@davenporttheatrical.com and you can reach thousands and thousands of theater fans, as well as producers, marketers, and actors all across the world who have one thing in common. They love the theater. Email chris@davenporttheatrical.com to hear how you can sponsor the podcast.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.